your size, grab your jaws, and give Winnie a welcome from Oklahoma.
Boy, when I looked out there across the thing this morning, it didn't look like there was this many, so I wasn't really as nervous as I should have been. Hi, everybody. My name is Winnie Eddy. I'm the wife of an alcoholic, a member of Al-Anon, and I'm not always grateful for either one. Well, there are those times, you know, but I guess I should tell you in all honesty that I really believe that Al-Anon is more reliable than himself. However, he tells me that's a matter of opinion, and there's one small thing he seems to have forgotten, and that is that until I came to Al-Anon, he didn't have an opinion. So, it's sort of what you might call getting stuck with your own recovery. I'm really very happy to be in Oklahoma. This is a part of Oklahoma I never saw before, you know. Of course, it isn't on Route 66, so I guess I can be forgiven. And I must say, Susan, when you told them to see me after the meeting, I didn't know you wanted me to help them hide them. I thought you wanted me to help them find them. I have grown some, but not necessarily up here, more like out here, but that's a whole other story. I never have trouble getting started, usually. It's stopping, but in deference to Luann, I'm going to try to make this as easy as possible. I want you to know from the very beginning that I'm not an authority on Al-Anon. I haven't got the slightest idea how it works, and I'm glad. Because if I knew how it worked, I'd change it. That happens to be my pattern. I figure things out, and then I take care of them. I didn't come to Al-Anon for the good reasons. I didn't come because I wanted it, and I didn't come because I needed it, and I certainly didn't come because I thought it could help me. I didn't know there was anything wrong with me. I came because I'm married to a nut. And he decided to go into the hospital and do something about his drinking, despite the help I had been giving him. And one of the conditions was that he attend AA meetings. Now, it was at an AA meeting that he heard of Al-Anon. And it has always been a mystery to me why he sat down, took the time to write a letter to the Al-Anon Central Office in Los Angeles and tell those complete strangers that there was something wrong with me. And when I got here, I didn't stay for the good reasons. I didn't stay because I liked it. I didn't like it. I didn't like it to the point that I tried to join Alcoholics Anonymous. I took their 20 questions test, and I flunked it. And so one day I went to the guy that I thought was the big shot in our particular area. He was the one that always got the chair with the seat in it. Because well, contrary to the way meeting rooms and a lot of clubs are furnished today, when I came into Al-Anon, they used to furnish them with rejects from the Goodwill. And if you didn't hit your bottom before you got there, you'd hit shortly thereafter, you know. None of the darn things had any springs, but this one got the chair that held up. Looked sort of like a throne, tell you the truth. And I figured he had to be at least a supervisor, so I went to him one day and I confessed. I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And he said, what makes you think so? Well, I said, I flunked your test. Oh, he said, if you flunked that test, then the chances are you are an alcoholic. When did you have your last drink? Well, I said, I think it was about 3 years ago. And he said, lady, if it's been 3 years ago and you got to think about it, go back over with those women and let them help you. Now, I don't know what shape you were in when you got to this way of life, but I want you to know that in my condition, being rejected by Alcoholics Anonymous didn't help me a lot. And I went back over with those women, I think probably because I wanted to help them, or get them to help me get even with them. See, that was sort of my way of life. I was always recruiting these people to help me get even with those people. And pretty soon these people became those people. You know. And so it was really kind of an active way of life. But I got back over there and I stayed probably because there happened to be one female in that group that was the nastiest woman that I have ever come in contact with. And I decided to outsit her. It wasn't so much what she said to me. She never really said anything. But she'd look at me and she'd go... And I didn't know what that meant, you know. And she knitted, which almost drove me up a wall, you know, because I don't knit. And when you're perfect and you don't knit, you're in big trouble. But I didn't even begin to believe I was sick, which is one of the first things they told me, until I began to like her. And then I went immediately to my sponsor, and I said, I think I'm beginning to like her. And my sponsor had one answer for every situation. It's all right. I could have told her I shot my husband, and she'd say, it's all right, you know. And I said, well, no, it really isn't. And she said, why? And I said, because I have never changed my mind about anyone. And that was the truth. You see, I put people in categories, those you encouraged, those you tolerated, and those you ignored. And once I had you placed, you had to stay there. Because I didn't know how to shuffle you around. And I realized today that I probably deprived myself of a lot of very meaningful relationships because of my inability to allow people to be whatever they want to be. Now, I know there are some alcoholics here. Gene counted them last night. Are there any Al-Anons? Well, you be patient because I'm going to give the alcoholics their message first. Well, you know how they are, and truth of the matter is I'm not even sure I got a message for them, but I talked out in Fontana one night. It really wasn't one of my better days, and so it kind of surprised me when this woman came up to me after the meeting, and she said, where are you going to be the next time? And I said, well, I'm not really sure. Why? Oh, she said, I would just love to have my husband hear you. So I figured I must have said something profound, but I couldn't remember what it was. So I asked her. I said, do you think I could help your husband? Well, she said, not really, but after he hears you, he's going to be glad he got me. That may be the only message you get, but it works in our team, too. We put on a little play in March, I guess it was, for our Al-Anon convention in California. And then we did it again for a fundraiser. And some guy stopped me in the hall after the meeting and after the play, and he says, lady, I've heard you talk, and you're right. You made me grateful for my wife. He said, but today you made me grateful for her mother. Because that's the part I play in the show. Say, I'm the mother-in-law. Anyhow, I only have one story. I don't apologize for it because there isn't a way in the world that I can change what I used to be like. But what I can do today, thanks to places like this and people like you, is use those so-called unhappinesses of the past as a stepping stone into a better way to live today. So for the next few minutes, if my watch don't stop, I'm going to share a little experience, strength, and hope, and tell you some of what I used to be like, what happened, and in my particular case, I let you guess. You know, there are people that still don't think I'm going to make it. Which is perfectly all right, because that's one of the things I learned in Al-Anon. You see, it really doesn't bother me how much they worry about me. It's only when I begin to worry about them worrying about me that I get into all the trouble. I was brought up in a family where I thought there was a drinking problem. In fact, he used to call my father an alcoholic, but I don't know whether he was or not. He didn't think he was. He thought he was a social drinker. He lived a social drinker, he died a social drinker, but he liked it. And when I wasn't helping him, he liked me too. But when I came to Al-Anon, I could spot an alcoholic 2 miles away. Anybody that was going into a bar, coming out of a bar, standing in front of a liquor store, or just looking strange, yeah, to me, was an alcoholic, because that's what I was accustomed to, strange people. And I never really knew where they came from, but they always ended up next door to me. I was always surrounded by these weirdos. Anyhow, in growing up, it wasn't really what my father did that bothered me. It was what my father wouldn't do that bothered me. You see, I happened to be a born researcher. And at a very early age, I started researching fathers. And it does take a little footwork, because you got to cover the neighborhood. You got to watch the fathers and then come home and look at yours, you know, or mine. He never did any of the things that I thought he should do. And I made a few suggestions, but I was raised in a hard-headed Irish family. My father just wouldn't take direction from a 4, 5, 6-year-old, whatever I happened to be. So right then is when I set a pattern to my life that lasted until I got to Al-Anon. I got even. I ignored him. And ignoring him made my life more miserable than all his drinking could have done if he'd have been drinking at me. You know, because when I was away at school, I could be honest about my mother, my brothers, and my sister, but never my father. Always described him the way he should be. And that made my life very, very difficult, because it meant nobody could go home with me. See, if they did, they were going to find out one of two things right now. The man that was living with my mother was not my father. Or that I was the biggest liar that ever came down the pike. Now, I never considered myself a liar. I looked upon myself as a diplomat, because I never lied. I just didn't tell the truth. And I thought there was a difference. See, I learned at a very early age, people anticipate what you're going to say. So you lead them up to a certain point and stop. They guess what you would have said if you'd have gone on. But they're very poor guessers. However, I never felt I should be held responsible for their inadequacies. And I have trouble with that even sometimes today, because since my husband has been sober and taken an interest in my welfare, which is just a nice way of saying he don't tell me to drop dead as often as he used to, but if I'm going someplace that's quite a ways away, he usually volunteers to go with me. Now, this, at least for me, is a test of serenity. Because I happen to be married to the original. Don't know where he's going when he leaves. He don't know where he is when he gets there. And usually he don't know where he's been when he gets back. But if he goes with me, he directs me every step of the way, you know. And we're at opposite ends of the pole when it comes to being anything alike. Because I'm married to a thinker. Sometimes he thinks 2, 3 weeks before he answers you. You know, which really isn't as bad as it sounds. It's a marvelous memory course, because you got to keep in mind everything you've been talking about. Because when he comes up with the answer, he never connects it to anything. You know, he just says, yes. I'll give you a better example. Since he's given up drinking, he's taken up dusting. It's almost as bad as drinking. But anyhow, we were playing golf one day, and I happened to look over, and here he is, dusting the golf cart, you know, which I thought was ridiculous. So when I got back in the cart, I merely said to him, when you die, I'm going to bury you in a plastic bag. And he didn't say anything, so I didn't say anything. But about 2 weeks later, I guess, we were having what I thought was a nice, friendly cup of coffee, and all of a sudden, He said, I don't think that was very nice. Yeah. He thought it over. He didn't like the bag idea, I guess. I don't know. But anyhow, that's the way he is, and it's okay. I'm getting used to it. But on the other hand, I'm one of those people that reacts immediately. You know, I try to get it done before I really know what you want me to do. So when you put two people like that in one automobile, a little problem. So on this particular night, I'm going to tell you, well, you know, if we're driving down the freeway and he says, turn right, I turn right now. And he says, not here, you know. I'm always about 60 miles too soon or something like that. So. Anyhow, one of the greatest trips we ever had was on that Turner Turnpike, you know. We couldn't go anyplace but straight ahead. But anyhow, on this particular night, I had been asked to come down to Chula Vista, and I was having a moment of growth, or whatever you want to call it. I knew I was not well enough to go that far with him without running over him. But I didn't want to tell him. I didn't want him to go. See, he gets hurt awfully easy. And then I have to make amends, you know. And oh, God. I didn't want to get involved in all that stuff. So I just said to him, I'm going to a meeting. He said, okay. So I left, but that night I didn't get home at 10:30 or a quarter of 11. It was more, well, like a quarter of 1. And when I walked through the door, there he stood in my spot. With that age-old question, where the hell have you been? And without even thinking, you know, I said, well, how far do you think it is to Chula Vista? Now, he accused me of lying to him. I didn't lie to him. Didn't tell him I wasn't going to Chula Vista. And if he had said, Winnie, are you going to Chula Vista? I was going to say yes. You get the picture? If you were bright enough to ask the right question, you got the whole story. And if you weren't, you got stuck with what you thought. And I might add, that gets you into a little trouble problem sometimes also. But anyhow, I don't know what happened to the man that I met, fell in love with, and permitted to marry me. But as soon as he was mine, I decided to help him. I wanted to help him become what I knew he wanted to be for my sake. Now, I'm not well enough yet to define that, but I'm going to tell you something that I didn't tell him, and that is that my help is deadly. I had friends. They wouldn't even tell me they were in trouble for fear I'd help them, you know, because I have that knack of lousing things up. Well, ask Lou Ann and Hank, you know. I led them into the snack last night, and we were the last people to eat. But anyhow, when Eddie and I got married, you know, we ceased to be friends. We became competitors. He spent his life trying to outwit me, and I spent my life trying to outwit him. And the upshot of the whole thing was, well, we ended up a couple of halfwits. He was in the Navy. He was a professional man, full lieutenant, and I didn't go into this blindly. Like I said before, I'm a researcher, sort of by nature. And I, unfortunately, for me in the Navy, researched the Navy. And I happened to come across the table of operations, and I noticed that there was only a couple of lines between what he was and what I decided to help him become, which was admiral. Well, I knew they only had one admiral in the dental corps. I only had one man in mind for the job. It didn't look as difficult as it turned out to be, but had I been halfway bright, I'd have joined the Navy myself. I showed up every day. He only showed up when the spear moved him, and I would have made a marvelous shore patrolman. You know, I got a little bit of bird dog in me. You're right. You know, when I'd show up and find out he hadn't shown up, I'd just put my nose to the ground, and away I'd go. Sooner or later, I always found him. But by then, he was usually in no shape for me to let anybody else find him. So that's when I used to hide him. We played hide and seek for years. Of course, he didn't even know there was a game going on, but after he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I really felt I should help him with the program because I wasn't too sure he was bright enough to get what they said they wanted to give him. So I went to every meeting and had a little notebook, and I would jot down a few of the pertinent things that applied to his peculiar case, and then I'd sort of spoon-feed it to him. Well, you know, if they had an examination, I wanted the dummy to be able to pass. And I heard two things at those meetings that are worse than drinking. Would you believe there are a lot of things that are worse than drinking? Sobriety, for instance, for the non-alcoholic. You know, I don't know about anybody else, but it was always easier for me to watch Eddie throw up than grow up. It just worked out that way. I didn't really have any control over it. But one of the things I heard was sleep teaching. I got myself a big AA book, and every night, just as he dozed off, I would open into chapter 5, and I would read to him. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. It was a beautiful reading, and I memorized the whole 5th chapter, and dummy slept through the whole damn thing. And I still think it's the reason when we go to an AA meeting outside our own area, you know, where when you walk in, people don't really know which one's which. It's always me they come up to. You know, they say, keep coming back, honey. It'll work. I don't know. The other thing I heard was you can't get drunk if you're grateful. Now, right after I came to Al-Anon, they removed from my vocabulary some of my finer phrases, such as, you had better not be drunk tonight. If I smell liquor on your breath, your clothes will be on the porch. My neighbors thought I was some kind of a fresh air nut. I put them out every night, brought them in every morning, you know. But they wouldn't let me say that, so I had to find some way to get the message across. So when I heard that bit about gratitude, I just latched right onto it, you know. And every morning when Eddie left for the office, I'd say, now remember, today, be grateful. And he'd say, for what? You know, because the last thing that came home was his disposition. But anyhow, I used to give him things to be grateful for, but I wasn't really all that grateful myself in those days. So probably without even realizing it, I think I started one of the first gratitude lists for him. I jotted down a few of the things he should be grateful for, starting with myself, of course. And while I was doing this, I happened to remember this game of hide and seek. So one morning I explained to him, I happen to be a great explainer. Hank mentioned last night that he went through life explaining. I did too, you know. I was one of those people who couldn't say yes or no without giving you a detailed explanation. And I'm not much better than that today, to tell you the truth. The example I usually use is my watch, not this one, but I always wanted a watch with a little teeny-weeny tiny face, something that would, kind of reflect my personality, you know. As soon as my eyes got bad, Eddie bought me one. Well, yeah. His timing is perfect. I complained about it so much that he got me another one, a big one, you know. And in my enthusiasm, I pulled the stem out. Well, Lord, I didn't want him to think I was abusing his gifts. So I fixed it myself, which is something that we Al-Anons, you know, we can fix anything. And it worked very well for quite a while, but I happened to be up in Kanab, Utah, and some poor unsuspecting Utahn, noticing I had a watch, asked me what time it was. Well, I had to tell him about the watch with the little teeny-weeny face and the bad eyes and pulling out the stem and fixing it myself, and I have to keep it wound. It gains 5 minutes every 24 hours. Now, there's an hour's difference between Kanab and California. And I finally figured it out, and I looked up, and the man was gone. I think one of the things that upset me was I felt like 007, you know, talking to my wristwatch on the corner in Kanab. But I was up there just about 3 weeks ago. We went up there to play golf, and I walked slowly through town, but nobody asked me what time it was. I don't know. I guess the word got around. Anyhow, that's the way I am. But, of course, Eddie was a captive, so one day I did explain to him that when he drank excessively, it had been necessary for me on occasion to hide him. And I'd put him in some rather out-of-the-way places, but I'd never lost him. So be grateful. And I did put him in some strange places. The one that I usually tell about happened down at the Long Beach Naval Station. And I tell it primarily because it points out a lot of things about me. But they used to have a mock submarine just inside the sentry gate. And one morning I came across Lloyd John with his six-pack of beer at the exact moment that I spotted his commanding officer coming from the opposite direction. Well, I had just told that man one of my better stories, which meant I had to get rid of him. I mean, you can understand, he was living proof I hadn't told the whole story. But you should remember one little item, and that is that when I came to Al-Anon, I had one of the greatest pitching arms in the world. I could throw a full six-pack of beer farther than he had strength enough to retrieve it. So if I was around and he had a six-pack of beer, you know, he'd hold it like I was going to take it away from him. They've often said if there was any physical violence in my family, I was it. But anyhow, I had to get rid of him someplace, and the only place I had to put him was in that submarine. Now, getting him in isn't as hard as it sounds. I just helped him up, and he fell down. He didn't know where he was going. But getting him out, that's a whole other story. See, he didn't trust me, so he wouldn't hand me the beer. And I have many times since wondered what that sentry must have thought of that female, you know, half in, half out of the conning tower, that darn submarine, finally coming up with this lieutenant commander holding his beer in his hat. He thought he'd been torpedoed in the middle of Long Beach, you know. He didn't know where he was. But I wonder about that sentry because I used to go on that base like I owned it in my housecoat and my curlers. I don't really think the alcoholic appreciates what we give up in order to help them. Now, in my particular case, it was dressing. And I did have a choice. You know, I could always go to bed in whatever I was going to wear the next day. But I don't know. You don't really get that comfortable feeling you have with one of them old house coats, you know. Mine was a chenille number. I sort of had double duty. If I got upset, I'd pluck it, you know, while I planned. And I didn't find out until here not too awfully long ago that my kids had a formula for my behavior. If she puts her shoes on, she's going out, and if she gets dressed, we're moving. But it's only taken them 20 years to tell me that, you know. They didn't want to hurt my feelings, but anyhow, I was down at the Naval Hospital yesterday. I go down there occasionally so some of these fellas in the ACR or ARC or whatever the unit is can see what a Navy wife shouldn't be. And they've got a sentry on the gate now. And when I pulled up, this guy walked out, and very sternly he said to me, "Let me see your ID card." Well, I didn't have one. So I told him I didn't have one because this program teaches you to be honest. He says, "You got a driver's license?" I said, "Sure." So I showed him my driver's license, and he let me go right through. Now, my driver's license don't look a damn thing like me, so I didn't feel real secure. But the girl that was with me said, "How come he didn't ask to look at my driver's license?" And I said, "Because you don't look like a terrorist. I do." Anyhow, oh boy, I guess you know how I felt when Eddie came home and announced he had resigned from the Navy. I was like somebody that had lost a business, you know, because I had started to wonder about him. That's true. Never blamed the drinking. I didn't want my husband to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and quit drinking. I wanted him to learn to mind. See, I never objected to him having a drink. Sometimes I gave him two, and there were times when three were called for. But there was something very strange about him that I didn't understand. It seemed like one drink and he was set in cement. I didn't know what to do. You know, I couldn't do anything with him. And I don't know how many times I said to him, "When we are invited to a cocktail party on Friday, we can come home on Friday." We don't have to stay till Monday, you know. Because it seemed, you know, it seemed like one drink, and as I say, he was set in cement. But I think part of my confusion stemmed from the fact that I like those cocktail parties. See, I like that nice, easy social life in the service. I didn't even mind making a fool out of myself, occasionally. He was making a career out of it. And the strange thing is, as his drinking increased, mine decreased. It became more important for me to know where he was, who he was with, where he was going, how he was going to get there. Or what was he thinking? Have you ever tried to read somebody's mind through their eyeballs when their lids are at half-mast? Yeah. It's not easy. And when I first got to this, see, I wasn't trying to figure out what alcohol did to him. I was trying to figure out where I lost control. And when I first got here, and my sponsor took me to a lot of AA meetings, which I'm very grateful for. And, you know, I'd hear all these things, and they kept talking about the first drink. The first drink. And I'd say, it isn't the first drink. But I couldn't remember whether it was the second or the third or the fourth. See, I was still not connecting the alcohol with him. I was still connecting the alcohol with my control. And I got so bad about it that Wilma said to me one day, Winnie, don't help him. Let him suffer. And I didn't like him anyhow. So I quit helping him. And then as God has a way of doing in my life today, I ended up at an AA meeting one night, and the man talked almost exclusively on the first drink. And later on, we ran into him in the coffee shop, which is to say that we got in the same coffee shop, and I spotted him. So I said to Eddie, I think I'll run over there and tell that man that if he intends to talk at a public level, he should be a little more factual. And I always like to give the devil his due. I want you to know my husband has never deprived me of making as big a jackass out of myself as I want to. So he sat very quietly while I traipsed across the coffee shop, sat down with this complete stranger, and picked his talk apart, you know. Man was in sort of a state of shock. He'd never laid eyes on me before, and had to be a railroad man from Texas. And when he finally got his voice back and that glaze sort of left his eyes, you know, and he kind of stared at me for almost a full second, and then he says, honey, let me put it to you this way. When you get killed by a train, it ain't the caboose that did it. And I haven't had any trouble with the first drink since, you know. I could see that train go by. Well, anyhow, I was a long way from Al-Anon at that point. I still thought a good wife was responsible for making something out of whatever she got stuck with. So I began to wonder, what am I going to do with him? You know, I had long since begun to realize that making an admiral out of him hadn't been easy when he was in the Navy. But when he got out of the Navy, it was impossible. And while I was thinking about it, I happened to remember his mother. Now, I never liked his mother, but it was really no big deal. You know, there were a lot of people I didn't like. Whole towns, you know. When I moved out to the West Covina area, I happened to be mad at El Monte. And so I want you to know that I used to drive down through Long Beach to get to L.A. so that I didn't have to go through El Monte. And one day my sponsor said to me, do you like to drive? And I said, no. She said, then I think you should forgive El Monte. So there was one little peculiar thing about Eddie's mother. She didn't believe in drinking anything. You know, water, okay. Coffee, tea, or milk, out of the question. So it suddenly dawned on me that has got to be his problem. You see, he wasn't raised in a social drinking family such as mine. Therefore, the poor thing probably just doesn't know how to drink. So I decided to teach him. Have you ever tried to teach a drunk how to drink? Well, you got at least one big problem. You got to get him sober enough to find out if he's learning anything that you're teaching him. So in order to do that, I had to get him out of California, naturally, because to me, California was one large bar separated by an occasional liquor store. And I decided to bring him back here to the Middle West, where people are really people. That's where I'm from, too. And that decision lasted till I got to Gallup, New Mexico, anyhow. I spent 3 miserable days in that godforsaken place just because I made one tiny mistake. I stopped. And Eddie got into a bar that I was afraid to follow him into, you know, because, well, from where I was sitting, he and a tribe of Indians went in, and I'm a great John Wayne fan, you know. I know what Indians and Firewater do when they get mixed up together. And they weren't going to get me, and I didn't care if they got him, so I sat outside and waited, and never dawned on me there was a back door, you know. He went in the front door, out the back door. Wherever he wanted to go, in the back door, out the front door. There's Old Faithful, out and right where he'd left her. And I always like to mention there was a little Indian gal standing in front of that place. And I like to mention her because I think she was my first contact with that very special something that I think I have found in Al-Anon. In AA, they call it the unspoken language. But in Al-Anon, at least for me, I think it's the language of the heart. This is the only place in my life that I have ever been where I can feel what somebody else is saying. Or I can watch them walk through the door for the first time. I don't have to know who they are, where they came from, what their husband does. What kind of a car do they drive? I don't have to have statistics. I just look in their eyes. And when I see in their eyes that same, there ain't nobody home here look that I've seen in my eyes, I know where they've been. But I was a long way from Al-Anon. I looked at that little Indian gal, and I was so embarrassed for her that she would allow herself to be degraded by standing in front of that place. I'm across the street making peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for 5 children, and she looks strange to me. But the second day, she looked pretty good. And the third day, it kind of hid her, you know. She had her side of the street, and I had mine. And if you've ever been to Gallup, New Mexico, that's all it is, 2 sides of the street. And we had them both covered. Well, anyhow, I had to make one of my many decisions. That's what my life's been, you know, one decision after another. In fact, when I came to Al-Anon, my sponsor told me I was probably one of the very few people she'd ever met that could starve to death in a cafeteria, you know. But anyhow, I decided that I would never again stop where the human race could contaminate my husband. Now, if you're driving across country in an automobile and you don't intend to stop, you have to make adjustments. And some darn fool told me Texas had dry counties. Well, I like to never got out of Texas. I mapped out a course so that I never stopped unless I was in a dry county, which didn't do a lot of good because they put one dry one between 2 wet ones, you know. And besides that, Eddie got just as drunk in a dry one as he would have in a wet one. And in a way, it was kind of a help, you know, because you could spend hours wondering, where did he get it? I don't know where they get it. But I do know today that if I had walled him up someplace, he'd have come out drunk. I don't know where they get it, you know. But my kids think Texas is the biggest place on earth. Because it took us almost 2 weeks to get through it. And it was kind of an unwritten law, you know. If she stops and you got anything to do, get out, get it done, and get back. She'll never miss you. And that's about the way it was. You know, I concentrated on that seat. And if it was full, we went. If it was empty, we waited. See how simple it is? Of course, God alone knows how much time we lost when he got in the back by mistake. I never looked back there. That is not where he is supposed to be. And I could depend on those kids. They never would have said anything. One of their favorite sayings was, don't upset her. Which used to upset me, you know. Now, it's only my opinion, which is all I'm offering today, but I don't think my kids reacted to the alcoholic. My kids reacted to my reaction to the alcoholic. Because it's true, Eddie came home drunk lots of times. He did very strange things. But they knew he was drunk. They knew he was strange. How do you explain me? I am running the group, and I don't know where I am half the time. You know, I have one kid. Our number two son, I could not keep him in school. Take him to school, he was usually beating me home. And after he got to go into Alateen and I got to go into Al-Anon, and we could talk as people instead of God and the little child. You know, which is sort of the way it was. And I asked him one day, and I said, Billy, why wouldn't you go to school? Didn't you like school? He said, yeah, Mom, I really did. But I was afraid you'd move while I was gone. And, you know, that can be a real fear to a little kid. But anyhow, finally got over here to Kansas, you know. I picked that very carefully because I'm a native-born Missourian, raised on the propaganda that Kansas is a dry state, which it's not. Everything they drink in Missouri, they haul over from Kansas. But we were there less time than we were in Illinois or Texas or any place else until Eddie found a bar within walking distance, because naturally I took the car away from him just like you would any other 10-year-old child that you're taking care of. So every morning he'd walk down to this place, and it tickled me. After he got sober, he told me he had to pass a Catholic church on this John. Now, I'm Catholic, he's not. In fact, for years, Larry, I thought I was doing penance for marrying that Methodist, but that's another story. Anyhow, he told me that he went into this church one day, and he lit a candle, and he said a prayer for me. And then he noticed a sign that said the candle cost a quarter. He didn't want to spend a quarter, so he blew it out. And I have never had nerve enough to ask him, you know, were you praying for me or against me? Because that's about the time the fun started. Now, here again, and it's still just my opinion, but I think the non-alcoholic is by far sicker than the alcoholic. Because you take a drunk to a meeting. Maybe you don't get him sober, but you get him dry. And right now, you're going to see a difference. But you take someone like me. Perfect. Never did anything that I couldn't explain. If I had enough time. Devoted myself to my family, to my community, to the Red Cross, to the DAR, to the Navy Relief, to anything to get my hands on. You know, I was devoted. And tell me I'm sick. How can you be sick and do what I did? Or that I have to change? Well, how would you improve on perfect? And that's what I was. Miserable? You better believe it. I was perfectly miserable. Nothing upset me like a good day. Haven't you ever had one of those? Where everything's going just the way it's supposed to, and you're sitting there waiting. And you go to bed at night and you're absolutely exhausted. And you ain't done nothing but wait. You know? The other reason I think the non-alcoholic is sicker is because occasionally Eddie would quit drinking. Not me, I was crazy all the time. Because if he quit drinking, I'd try to figure out, what did I do to stop him? And while I'm trying to figure out what I did to stop him, he starts again. Now I got to find out what starts him. So if I ever stop him, I'll never start him again. Over and over and over. But he did quit drinking all of a sudden there, and I had decided to help him become a millionaire, but I didn't tell him. You know, you never want to let him know what you're doing with him. A little voice told me I had about 2 weeks and I'd better get busy, so I picked out a small, unsuspecting town in the state of Missouri that needed a dentist. And then I went up to see a friend of my father's in Kansas City who, unfortunately for him, was in the dental supply business. I talked that man into giving me $17,000 worth of dental equipment, and I set up one of the most beautiful dental offices you have ever seen. And I had patients, too. No dentist. Because while I was busy doing all that work, he found the one place I'd overlooked when I canvassed that town, a bar called Blondie. You know, he always went in for those exotic places. And to the best of my recollection, he was only out of that bar and in that office once. That's when a man came in that I decided to help. So I went down to Blondie's. Now, I don't know how you react to stress, but I want you to know that when I get upset, my hair stands right straight up. And it isn't so much that my eyes come out, but my skin goes back. And it gives me kind of a ferocious look, you know, and I'd float into those bars like an avenging angel, and I demanded he go with me. And he's not the world's bravest man, Johnny can vouch for that. And we get back to the office, and the first thing that this jerk said was, "I'm allergic to Novocaine, Doc, but I got my own anesthesia." So he took a bottle out of his pocket. He had a drink. The dentist had a drink. They pulled the tooth. They both went back to Blondie. And that's when I made up my mind that that town could suffer. I wouldn't help them.
Please turn your tape. Do not rewind. Turn your tape and continue on side two.
Today, as I have been many other days, I'm grateful that drunk as he was, sick as he was more emotionally stable than I was cold sober. You see, those people weren't people to me. I didn't really care whether he helped them or not, and I don't think in the final analysis it was my undying love that kept me trying to do something with him. I had that crazy idea that when he changes, I'm going to be all right. That is not the way it worked for me. You see, I'm one of those people that was brought up to believe you must be successful. Spent my whole life looking for success. I couldn't find it. I didn't even know what it was. And I didn't really find out until I had been in Al-Anon for quite a long time. And my number one son got drafted, and I didn't really want to join the Army, but I, you know, he's a lot like his father. In fact, he called me on the phone not too awfully long ago, and he said, "Mother, do you think I'm an alcoholic?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Because you're drunk." And he said, "What do you mean by that?" And I said, "I've never seen a drunk alcoholic. Every alcoholic I've ever seen in my life stood right up here and said, 'My name is Joe. I'm an alcoholic.'" And he was cold sober, you know. So it's going to take him a little while to find out I call him a drunk, but that's another story, too. But when he got drafted, you know, I had that feeling. I couldn't let go. And I went to the meetings. I didn't tell him I had something on my mind, you know, because I'd been around for a while. You're not supposed to let people know. But I hinted a lot. And one night, my girlfriend, the one with the, you know, she got kind of tired of listening to me, I guess. I don't know. Because she said to me, "Winnie, why don't you get off that kid's back and allow him the dignity of failure?" I'd never heard those two words used in the same sentence before. I didn't know there was a dignity to failure. But she went on to say, if he never fails, he can't possibly succeed. Because if he's never experienced one thing, he'll never recognize the other. And do you know that since that night, I haven't been to an Al-Anon meeting, to an AA meeting, or even to an Al-Ateen meeting. And I'll bet you haven't either. That you haven't watched someone walk in here, stick around, and become a success. Now, I don't mean from a monetary standpoint, because success to me today doesn't have a price tag on it. It isn't something you invite people over to or drive them around the block in or wear to a party. Success to me today is the ability to get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and know who I am. Or to stand here right this minute and say, "My name is Winnie Eddy, and know who I'm talking about." Because you see, all my life, I had a name, I never had an identity. I was always somebody's wife, somebody's mother, somebody's daughter, somebody's granddaughter, somebody's something. Who am I? I asked my sponsor that question. Very sick woman. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her in just a second. One day I said to her, "How do you find out who you are?" And she said, "Dear, when you have cake for dessert, how do you serve it?" See what I mean? But I humored her a lot, so I told her. I said I take a pretty good-sized piece, and I give it to Eddie, and then I'm very even with the children, and sometimes there's a little piece left over for me, and sometimes there isn't. She said, "Yeah, that's what I thought. That's the way you live your life, too." I said, "What?" She said, "You take a big chunk of your life, and you give it to him. And then you're very even as far as the children are concerned. And once in a while, there's a little piece left over for you, but most times there isn't." I said, "Well, what do you do in a case like that?" "Oh," she said, "it's very simple. You take the first piece of cake." And that's what I try to do. One day at a time, to the best of my ability. Because, you see, I'm I'm one of those people, if I do for you in preference to doing for me, you better believe I'm setting you up. And it may take years before I call in that marker, but someday it's going to be your fault that I didn't do what I wanted to do, be what I wanted to be, or have what I wanted to have. Because, you see, left to my own devices, I fall into that crevice of unworthiness. And it's a long, hard crawl back up to where I can accept that I, too, am entitled to as good a life as I've got guts enough to want. All I have to do is be able to take the responsibility for my own actions, and the world is mine. I left California with 5 children. I have 8 altogether, and usually I make you count them as they creep in just like I did. I was always surprised, but Eddie was a little shocked, too. You know, he thought I was babysitting, but that's his story. I try not to tell it too much. Anyhow, I probably have the only set of twins on earth that had to be explained, you know, because I knew, as I say, when I left California, I was expecting a baby, but I was very busy and with the dental office, and, you know, and so I hadn't done anything about it, because if you've got 5 children, having a baby's no big deal. But it was getting kind of close, so I went up to Kansas City to see this doctor. Now, whether you realize it or not, doctors are very happy people. Most of them are glad you're sick. This one, he was the joy boy of the whole bunch, you know. He just helped me in, patted me on the head, sat me down, hit me with a bat. He said, "Mrs. Eddy, you're going to have twins." Well, I almost died in his office, because I had problems. See, I had a dental office, no dentist, plus 5, and that thing I don't know what to do with. And besides all that, I knew what Eddie was going to say when I told him, because he said it. "There are no twins in my family." I got so involved defending my moral character that I forgot there were twins in my family. You know, it wasn't until my mother said to me, "Isn't it nice we have another set of twins?" I said, "In whose family?" She said, "Ours." I said, "Well, why didn't you tell me?" She said, "You never asked me." No big deal in that. I never ask anybody anything. Can you think of a better way for people to find out you don't know something than to ask them? Why, even when I used to get lost, I would pull into a filling station and I would say to the attendant, "Where are you located?" Because I knew that if I found out where he was, I'd know where I was. And he wouldn't know that I didn't know, see? Well, as I told you in the beginning, it was a letter that my husband wrote that got me to Al-Anon. And today, as I have been many other days, I'm grateful. Grateful that he cared enough to want us to share that very special something that he felt he had found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm also grateful to God, as I understand him today, that he sent me a sponsor with the patience of Job. Because I wasn't an easy nut to crack. You know, you had to catch me first. And the first day that Wilma came to my house, she found the front door nailed shut. Well, it was necessary. I was in no shape to cover 2 doors. I think pooped is the word. But anyhow, she went around the back, and the car was in the driveway, coffee pot boiling on the stove, and she yoo-hooed me, but she couldn't find me. So she went next door, and she asked this little old lady whether or not Mrs. Eddy was at home, you know. And Miss Martin said, "Well, even if she is..." She thought I was crazy. And I resented that, because I never bothered her. You know, I mean, once we did almost get trapped in the backyard together, I hid in the bushes till she went in. I didn't like her, you know. And my kids never bothered her. I didn't forbid them to go over there. I have always felt that forbidding children to do things leaves scars. So I always use just a little psychology, you know. Tell them the story of Hansel and Gretel. Let them make up their own mind. You want to end up in an oven? Go on over there. But She scared Wellman when she came back that night. She had a friend with her, and I don't know to this day how she got in. I used to ask her, but it upset her, so I had to stop. But I used to get my kids to bed on a production basis. You know, everybody in the tub, everybody washed, rinsed, out, dried, dressed in bed. Some other can worry. What happened? All of a sudden, I can hear it. Anyhow, Wilma came between the dressing and the drying process. And, God, I couldn't hide them. I couldn't even catch them. I had all these little naked bodies running around. But she never even hesitated. She picked up a towel, and she dried, and she talked. Alcoholics. Alcoholics Anonymous. Al-Anon family groups. I didn't even know they lived in the neighborhood. But she finally said the magic word, drunks. And I knew why she was there. She needed me. Yeah, well, she had a whole bunch of friends that had heard I had survived, and she was going to get them together, and I was going to give them sort of a refresher course or something, I don't know. But when she left that night, whatever she brought in with her went out with her. I gave her just time enough to get home, and then I called and told her that something very important had come up. I would be unable to attend the meeting she was scheduling. Now, I hadn't even done anything unimportant for a long time, but I couldn't let her find that out. I couldn't let her know how unimportant I thought I was. And that should have been the first chink in the armor. Should have been the first time I began to realize I never hid from you. I hid from me. Because, you see, a long time ago I got that crazy idea that I didn't measure up to what I thought you thought I ought to be. And so I built a wall that was supposed to keep you from finding out how truly inadequate I thought I was. The sad part of the story is I'm the one that got lost behind the wall. When I came to Al-Anon, I didn't laugh. I didn't cry. I didn't care. I knew it had to end. I just wanted it to hurry. But, you know, even a defect of character puts you in good stead once in a while. I had told this woman I would help her, and I didn't want to be beholden to her. So 2 weeks later, I went to my first meeting in Azusa, California. And I hope I never forget it. I don't ever want to be an old-timer in this way of life. I was an old-timer when I got here. But I want to remember every single solitary day what it felt like to walk from a world of absolute chaos into a place of absolute peace. Nobody cared who I was. Nobody wanted to know what my husband did. They were glad I was there. And that feeling that I've never been able to find words to describe, I still have even when I talk about it. But I can't seem to get them out, you know, because it's deep down inside. But like I said before, I'm not an easy nut to crack. I took as much of their free literature as I could take without looking interested. And then I borrowed a book. I didn't want to get financially involved. And I went home and I studied. I memorized the steps. I memorized the traditions. I even waited 24 hours before I complained. And then I called Wilma and I said, this isn't helping me at all. I'm still sitting in the playpen reading. And she said, sitting in the playpen? Well, that's for those of you who don't have 8 children. That's the only place you get any peace, you know. You don't even have to wonder where the kids are. They're outside watching you. And anyhow, it's kind of a makeshift reading room or library. She said to me, well, we don't memorize the steps. We work them. And that's when I first realized how sick this woman was. You know, there's not one direction. Not one. And she did make a mistake. She said, we use the same steps in Al-Anon that they use in Alcoholics Anonymous. Big deal. But if that's what she wanted, I would try it. First one said I was powerless over alcohol. My life had become unmanageable. That's not true. When it comes to alcohol, I can take it or leave it alone. If it hadn't been for him, I'd have managed beautifully. Figured that's his step, so I left it for him. And then the second one had kind of an unfortunate word. It said, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. Even an idiot, you know, knows that if you're going to be restored, you've got to be nuts to begin with. And he was, but I wasn't. So I left that one for him, too. I went back to that one. Well, I went back to all of them, but that one particularly because one of my favorite pastimes used to be hiding his car. You know, I'd put it in one place I knew he'd never look, which was the garage. And then I'd watch him while he covered the town looking for his car. And when I thought he had been punished enough, I would take it out of the garage and put it right back where I got it. Now, maybe that isn't crazy, but the pleasure I used to get. That's crazy, see? But the third one, which asked me to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, I was going to skip that one for both of us, you know, because it said, as I understood him. And I understood him, he did not understand me. And I didn't really hate Eddie enough to turn him over. So like I say, I was going to skip that one for both of us. Now, I wasn't going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, but to give it to anybody else on earth. They didn't even have to ask for it. And the example I usually use is our L.A. freeways. When I get on the freeway, I go right over to the left-hand lane that goes straight ahead, and that's where I'm going. I don't know why. There's always some stinker gets right on behind me, pulls just ahead of me, moves over, and then slows down. Which means I got to get over here, get ahead of him, move back over, and slow down. So he will know how I feel. So he gets ahead of me, and then I get ahead of him. And then he gets ahead of me, and then I get ahead of him. About 5 miles up the road, he puts on his right-hand blinker, moves over, leaves the freeway. Because he's home. I'm 5 miles past my turn. Because he has had control of my life. But I wasn't going to turn it over to God. However, I did notice whenever I would call Wilma with a little situation, she'd say, well, just turn it over. But she never said to whom, which I can understand. It's an anonymous program. You know, I mean, you don't tell everybody who handles the problems right off. So one day I had a pretty big one, and I called her, and she got kind of, you know, how they get sort of with you. And she said, oh, for heaven's sakes, Winnie, turn it over. I said, don't get so upset. You've told me that for a long time. That's true. But you never said to whom. Well, she said, I thought you knew. You turn it over to God. I said, no, I don't. I haven't even told him I'm going to Al-Anon yet. And I could tell by her tone of voice that this upset her. And I didn't want to upset her. So I began to wonder, what can I turn over to God that he can't louse up that will make her happy? And it took me almost 3 days. And finally I called her. I said, okay, Wilma, I'm going to turn something over to God. She said, what are you turning over? I said, my ironing. He said, you're ironing? I said, well, you said it didn't make any difference. Oh, no. She said, that's all right. That's all right. And I want you to know God don't like to iron either. And people have said to me, of all the things on earth, why the ironing? So I'll give you a fast explanation. When I came to Al-Anon, I was hooked on a washing machine. Used to wash like it was going out of style. Never ironed. And the minute Wilma found that out, she said, that is a defect of character. Which I corrected. I quit washing. But that didn't seem to satisfy her, so I did get around to where I'd iron one shirt at a time. That brought Eddie into the picture. He'd say, why do you only iron one shirt at a time? I said, I only live one day at a time. That's it, you know. He says one day to me, you know, I like a choice. I said, okay, pick out the one you want me to iron. So, I don't know. I kind of figured when I turned it over, I got rid of Eddie, I got rid of Wilma, I got rid of the ironing. It looked like a pretty good deal to me. But like I say, God don't like to iron either. I kept mine in a cabinet, but his slopped out of the cabinet, ended up in boxes. The boxes ended up in the rumpus room. It was a mess. And when one would come over, I'd say, have you seen the ironing? And that's when I got routine number one. It's all right. So I figured if it don't bother her and it don't bother him, I'm not going to let it bother me either. And then one night after an AA meeting in El Monte, this man walked up to me and he says, Winnie, you got a bunch of kids, don't you? And I said, yes, because I was admitting it by then. And he said, well, I go to an orphanage down in Mexico, and those little kids, they could sure use anything that possibly your kids have outgrown. So I promised him faithfully I would go right home. I would arrange everything. He could just pick it up at his leisure. But I'm a procrastinator by profession. He didn't follow me home. By morning, I forgot he asked me. And sometime after that, I came home from an Al-Anon meeting, and Eddie said, oh, by the way, Bill was by. He picked up the stuff for the orphanage. I said, he did? He says, yeah. I said, where'd you find it? He said, those boxes in the rumpus room. Now, for those of you who have not put it together, he got my ironing. And I want you to know that from that day to this, I have no problems turning things over to God. Because my God, as I understand him today, has some of the most unique answers. I never would have thought of sending them to Mexico. And besides all that, he made me look good, you know? Now, I don't tell that story to be blasphemous because I think this whole way of life is spiritual. But by the same token, I don't think God wants to listen to me cry for the rest of my life. I don't think one of the prerequisites of a happy existence is counting the cracks on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
You want my honest opinion? I think it kind of gives him a charge to hear me laugh and to know that finally I'm beginning to enjoy this life that he saw fit to give me. So I try to keep a light touch. Now, it don't work 100% of the time, but that's okay. If he louses it up, I forgive him. I've had people say to me, why do you keep going to Al-Anon? It's very simple. I'm nuts. And I can walk right out there today and do some of the same dumb, crazy things I used to do before when I become logical. And when I begin to understand, you know? I never understood anything that didn't get me in trouble. But there's another reason, too. See, I'm married to a game player. I'm a game player. But we don't play the same game, you know. Well, for instance, and I'll tell you this real quick and then I'll shut up. Eddie had a bad habit. He would come home, like, say, on Wednesday, and he'd take a look at me and he'd say, you know, Winnie, you could use a game of golf. Now, that's what he said. That is not what he meant. What he meant was he'd called everybody else and they were busy. And I know that, see. So I used to tell him how much I would love to go with him. However, today I was going to defrost the freezer or, God forbid, iron. But I always have a list of things I never got around to. And we'd play with that back and forth. You know, he'd try to convince me and I would, you know. And finally, he'd let me win. He'd go off and play golf. He'd have a beautiful day. I'm stuck with the freezer. And I didn't like the way that game was turning out. So I turned it over, and one night I went to a meeting, and I heard this girl say, whenever Paul asks me to do something that I really don't want to do, I merely say, I'd rather not. I kind of liked that because it had a kind of a classy ring compared to what I usually said. So I filed it away, and a few nights later, I'm at another meeting in an entirely different area. And there she is again. Nobody even asked her. And all of a sudden, she says, whenever Paul asks me to do something that I really don't want to do, I merely say, I'd rather not. Now, you figure it out. I've been to two meetings, two areas, and here's my answer. God sent her to tell me what I was looking for. So I waited, and the next time Eddie came home and said, Winnie, you look like you could use a game of golf. I looked him right in the eye. I said, I'd rather not. He said, what the hell do you mean you'd rather not? I said, I really don't know. That's all Maxine ever tells Paul. But it worked. And that's why I keep coming to Al-Anon. I would like to close with a little poem that I use every time I talk, which may mean nothing to you, which is perfectly all right with me. I didn't come down here to help you. I came down here to help me. And when I got this poem, the first time is when my mother was very ill, and I guess the look on my face told Wilma that there were no words in her command or at her command that were going to be sufficient to bring me out of this depression. So she handed me this plaque, and it had this poem on it. And the first time I read it, I had a mental picture of my kids. They used to come to me with their yo-yo. You know, they'd have the yo-yo clutched in this hand and the string attached to this hand. They'd say, come on, Mom, get the knot out of the middle.
And there wasn't a way in the world I could get a knot out of the middle of that string unless they handed me the yo-yo. And sometimes today, when I don't have time for the whole poem, that's my shortcut. Please, God, I've got another knot in the string. But anyhow, it goes like this. As children bring their broken toys with tears for us to mend, I took my broken dreams to God because he was my friend. But then instead of leaving him in peace to work alone, I hung around and tried to help with ways that were my own. At last I snatched him back and cried, "How can you be so slow?" "My child," he said, "what could I do? You never did let go. So if I don't leave anything else here today as my gift to you, I hope you'll remember just one thing. If you let go and you let God and you let the caring we're sharing here this weekend be a part of your life one day at a time, you got the recipe for a good day. Because you see, God loves us in spite of all we think we've done. And we love each other in spite of all we think we've done. And I love you because in my wildest dream, I could never have found what you have given me so freely, the joy of living. Thank you, and God bless.